Sound? Still no sound? Hello? Hello? How's sound? Can hear? Hooray. Well, can I introduce you Crispin Pemberton Pigott, a shrop steward from Swaziland. He has a machine shop in Swaziland where he does wonderful things, and he exports those to unlikely places in Central and East Asia, where he makes a very considerable contribution to solving the problem of air pollution by burning all sorts of unlikely things like animal dung, like really awful coal, and has cleaned up the air of places like Ulaanbaatar. And we thought you'd, from the domestic energy point of view, you'd be interested to hear something from Crispin about how he's managed to achieve this. So without further ado, my shop steward from Swaziland.
Thank you very much, Philip. Can we make this work? There we go. Okay. I've been asked, how did I do it? And I've decided, here we are, we'll put it in the public domain. All of the drawings of what you're seeing are on my website, which is newdawnengineering.com, D-A-W-N, newdawnengineering.com. In the library, look under stoves, and then by country, and then by model, you can find how to build these things. So, this is heating and cooking in Central Asia. Something like 400 million people rely on coal for heating and cooking in Central Asia. And there are other solid fuels in use, particularly by the very poor and remote people. They're burning dung and wood. The majority, if they can afford it, burn coal. Even if they can't, they heat at night with coal. And in Ulaanbaatar, there's only one choice, and usually it's the lowest cost option. You have a parallel here on the Highveld in South Africa with the very poorest of people burning coal in an imbaulo or some other similar device. So, just to point out where Kyrgyzstan is, it's northeast of Iran, west of China. It is the northern Himalayas. It has lowlands and highlands in Bishkek. This year it was minus 27 in Narin district. On the right, it's typically minus 30 at night, and if you go out of town, it gets colder and higher. It's extremely mountainous and very large snowfall. So something big is happening, and we want to report that. The picture on the left is a BBC video, and the stove, one of the stoves is there on the left. That's a KG4. This lady, everyone involved in the program so far, they're on welfare. They're receiving about $60 a month total income, and this stove saves $48 a month in fuel purchases. So it's a very significant, it basically doubles people's income. We have new combustion process, which is the center picture is from a World Bank video that tries to explain it. The picture on the right is a picture into the combustion chamber of the stove on the left. The flame is about 400 millimeters tall, and you can see straight through it as if it's almost not there. And people look at it and say, well, that's a gas fire, it's not a coal fire. And the answer is yes, that's correct. It is coal gas. So coal is described as a dirty fuel because when you burn it, you get a lot of smoke. At least that's what people's experience is. And unfortunately, people compare, both for analysis, metrics, and claims, they compare domestic stoves with power stations because most people trained in mechanical engineering and thermal engineering are taught how to run power stations and large boilers. They're not taught how to operate or design or use domestic stoves. The main difference between them is a domestic stove is frequently ignited, and people do not start and stop power stations. For this reason, it has unique challenges. One is that the combustion chamber material has to be very advanced compared with a power station. It has huge thermal shock, and also the ignition emissions are far more important in a stove. So refueling is putting coal on top of a fire, which should never happen. Makes enormous amounts of smoke. There are about 12,000 models of Chinese coal-burning stoves, and they all work pretty much the same way. You load it on top, and it makes a huge pile of smoke, and then it's very clean after that. So we're trying to do this. Now, the political drivers are air quality, health, the coal industry, cold climate people. There are people selling briquettes. There's political interference up and down each accusing the other of, you didn't do anything about the air quality, and yes, I did, but you wasted the money. And then policy changes, major policy changes, without testing the effect of the change. For example, in Ulaanbaatar in 2012, the Prime Minister declared that coal, that the smoky, horrible coal from Nalakh coal mine would no longer be allowed in the city, and they sent soldiers out to close the mine. They would bring coal from Baganoor, 150 kilometers away, subsidize it, and they doubled the emissions of the city because no one had checked what happens if you put that coal in this stove and operate it that way. Double. It was almost a record. It went from 700 to 1420 milligrams per megajoule delivered. Dirty coal or clean stove? Or do we have a dirty stove burning clean coal? What is it? Why do people say, oh, coal is a dirty fuel because when you burn it, you get smoke. Burn it in what? What did you burn? How did you burn it? What size was it? How did you light it? Totally changes the equation. Okay, this is the stove in the middle. The model number now is 4.2, is MN 4.2, Mongolian 4.2. It looks a little odd. That little tiny hole on the sliding door is the only air entrance in the stove. All air used in combustion passes through that hole, and it's as little as 40 by 5 millimeter hole. It's absolutely gas tight, this thing. It has a 10 kilogram hopper. It has a cross-draft gasifier combustor. The grate is on an angle, as you'll see shortly. It has a single inlet for primary and secondary air, and if you close it, it proportionally reduces the primary and secondary air, reducing the power without changing the excess air level. It goes through, the coal goes through dehydration, then pyrolysis, coking, and gas burning. I showed you the picture of the gas burning phase. It has a refractory ceramic lining of a very high engineering standard, and it has a fixed heat exchanger bypass. And I want to point that out because it's a piece of the, that little piece there. It always leaks hot gas into the chimney, even when the stove is minus 40 degrees and you're lighting it. The very first hot air passes directly to the chimney to get it working, and when it's running at full power, it continuously bleeds hot gases into the chimney. And by that, we can control the draft at all times and under all conditions. So we call it a bleeder. The performance. This stove can operate from 3 to 14 kilowatts on the power, on the fire side. It, cooking power is on a very big hole. There's a lot of cooking power, 2.5 kilowatts. It has extremely low PM2.5 production and carbon monoxide. We have multiple reports, like the guy in the picture and his mother, say that it burns for 14 hours without being touched. So you fill it up twice a day with coal that's sized 25 millimeters and under. You have one little slider. When they want to cook, they open it, the fire comes up big, cooks, and then turn it back down again. And typically, people that own this stove leave it on low power almost the entire day. It's certainly probably 16 or 18 of the 24 hours it's on low power. It has a space heating efficiency of 80%. Coal burning produces inherent emissions. I'm going to talk about different kinds of emissions because of their source, and it's quite important to correct common misunderstandings about coal combustion and coal emissions. So there's inherent emissions, which is what you get no matter what, CO2 and water vapor. Those are inherent. If you burn coal, you're going to get CO2 and water vapor. Then we have products of incomplete combustion, which would be carbon monoxide instead of dioxide, volatile organic compounds, SVO, PAHs, tar, soot, and so on. Things that are incidental. They can be altered by changing the combustion conditions. And were I to have the wrong amount of air, or the wrong size of fuel, or loaded incorrectly, I would get some of these incidental emissions. Now, the problem we faced in the past is that incidental emissions are being called inherent emissions. I was this last year introduced in Kyrgyzstan to a coal that said, this is a high CO coal. I said, pardon? And they said, yes, this is a low CO coal, and this is a high CO coal. So we don't like this one. People won't pay as much for it because it has high CO. I said, oh. Impurity emissions can be minimized by pre-processing. So you can wash coal, brings the sulfur down. You can treat it in some way. And those are the impurities, as opposed to the main fuel, can be reduced. Changing the combustion conditions cannot, in principle, alter inherent emissions due to fuel impurities. Now, fly ash, the ash is in the coal. Whitbank D has a lot of ash in it. Total sulfur, mercury, arsenic, fluorine, these are contaminants in the coal, and you only by changing coals can you affect that. Obviously, it's a different fuel, like going from gasoline to diesel or something, it's different. So bypass emissions come from the ambient air. So if I'm testing a stove in an environment, in Beijing, we have a lab at the China Agricultural University, and we can get 300 or 400 micrograms per cubic meter as background PM2.5. Now that then goes into the stove and comes out the stove on the other side, and to which is added the emissions from the combustion of the coal. What we have found is stoves that not only don't produce any PM2.5, they clean the air that goes into it. And we can have 200 micrograms going in, and in the chimney, 12 coming out while burning Shaanxi raw coal. So Philip and Harold, the others, said, you know, I think people would like to know how you're doing that, because we all believe that it can't be done. So we have ambient N2, argon, and CO2. They're going in. We have to consider those. And ambient CO2 is frequently over 800 ppm, whatever you hear in the news. We frequently get 800 to 1,000 ppm as ambient CO2 in cities. In Jakarta, I didn't see last year one reading below 525, and it's coming from the ocean. It's blowing off the ocean. And Ulaanbaatar in the morning, it frequently rises to over 800, 900. It was 820 on Friday. So we have to consider that in doing the analysis. And then, we have ambient NO, CO, and all those other things. Okay. Polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. Now, these are particles. Let me tell you what the EPA says. They occur naturally in coal, crude oil, and gasoline. Now that's a claim that PAHs are an inherent emission because they could be in the coal, or maybe. They say they do, they occur naturally, and they also are produced. So they say two things. When coal, oil, gas, wood, garbage, and tobacco are burned, they produce PAHs. When, under what condition, in whose product are these produced? Because they're not inherent emissions. What does the EU say? EURL says, PAHs are chemical compounds that can result from combustion processes or from heating food. And if you have PAHs in your dried fish, it's probably from processing it, not the smoky fire that went into it. It's by far produced in the fish by heating them above 105 degrees. So food contamination with PAHs largely arises from production practices, although environmental contamination is an issue since they are formed during incomplete combustion processes. They are saying it is not an inherent emission. So we can scare people with they occur naturally and emerge when you burn coal, or it's from incomplete combustion because polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons burn very well if you make them hot and give them some oxygen. So volatile or semi-volatile PAHs can be formed from the decomposition of fragments arising during the combustion of hydrocarbon fuels. They should be categorized as incidental emissions and can be reduced or avoided entirely by having good combustion conditions. Now this overthrows certain paradigm where people are trying to scare others from using coal, saying it is inherently smoky, evil, bad, toxic, whatever, when in fact the inherent emissions are CO2 and water vapor, and then contaminants, are, if there are any, and coals vary enormously, so we have to look at what it contains. Now, to burn coal completely, you dry it, you pyrolyze it, and in these stoves, it's pyrolyzed very gently. The amount of coal being processed at once is about 4 liters. Even though the fire is running at, let's say, 8 kilowatts or so, which is a very low power for that amount of fuel, it's done very gently. Slowly heated, and they are pyrolyzed, and it produces a huge, thick smoke. That smoke is run through a coke bed. The coke bed is maintained by semi-coking the coal, coking the coal, and then having all the gases produced through it, and it does it on a continuous basis. Then we burn the coal gases in a controlled environment, very hot, quite low level of excess oxygen, and it gives that flame that you saw. It's slightly blue to pink, which is the glowing water vapor, and it's nearly transparent. It's difficult to photograph. When you see it, you can see it because it's moving, but in a photograph, it kind of vanishes because it's so pure. So starting, this is about the device. This is a German furnace copy. It was miniaturized and then given a cooking function and so on by, I can say, people before my time. I was asked to work on this in 2010. So this is Mongolia 2010. It has, number one is a hopper. Number two is a pyrolysis zone. Three, there's coke. Between it, there's semi-coke. Four, they're adding secondary air. But via a separate channel, and five is the gas burning area, and the grate, which I've highlighted there in bright green, so you can see that it's on an angle. What happens is the coal burns, shrinks, and falls down, shrinks and falls down, shrinks and falls down, until you get another little glowing red, you know, pieces of coal. They're at the bottom, and there's no volatiles inside, it's just ash, carbon, and a tiny bit of attached hydrogen. And so as they fall down, the ash goes down. If the coal has that property, not all of them do. So I've just got a coal last week, a couple of tons to try some semi-anthracite, and the ash was rather strong, kind of like Virginia coals, and you had to shake the grate about, say, every 6 hours or so. And you had to just shake it mechanically, then the ash would break and it would fall down. But other places like Karakeche, which is the popular coal in Kyrgyzstan, the Nalakh coal I mentioned earlier in Mongolia, they don't do that. You just leave it alone. Don't touch the stove, and it perfectly burns and drops its ash by itself, by its own movement. So the problems with that device were, it was really hard to light. Gas canister with flame like a blowtorch under it for 15 minutes to heat and so on. It was awful. It overheats the local lignites. Now, the only coals available in Ulaanbaatar, which has some of the worst, or has had some of the worst quality air on the planet, was caused by burning lignite in a wood stove. So it had high excess air, which meant a low gas temperature, it had a low thermal efficiency. It made a lot of CO and PM sneakage. Sneakage is a technical term. It means on the side of your burner, it's a little cold on the edges if you're chilling it, and the CO and the PM, they go around the side away from the flame, and they get over and then they go out. It sneaks around the fire and doesn't get burned. So that was a serious problem with this device. It had a thin fire that was quite wide and secondary air jets. And it was designed to operate at one power continuously forever, like a hot water boiler in a hospital. It was not a domestic stove design. And that was the main drawback. So it has a bypass. Now, this means that it opens and closes up here. So the fire would start and you could go to the chimney, and after a while you'd close it. It's quite common. People love, the designers love these things because, oh, it's so efficient. And I can turn it and then the heat will go down in the heat exchanger and back up. The problem is, if your stove goes out near the end of the fire, there's no longer enough draft in the cold chimney because the heat exchanger cooled it. The chimney's cool, there's very little draft, and the CO leaks through the cooking surface into the room, and you have 100 to 200 ppm CO in your kitchen, which we've measured. So that's caused by, during ignition, low draft, and during the dying fire, low draft. So that was an issue, and it simply wasn't able to cross a large power band. Couldn't do it. So this is... the very first thing we tried, GTZ was the contractor at the time, now GIZ, and this is the version 7, and this is 7.1. It has on the right a vertical hopper. ceramic being fired tiles, clay firebox. It has secondary air, which I showed you at the entrance point at number 4, and it has a larger, this one has larger heat exchanger. The secondary air comes in a similar place with this one. And it had quite a good success. The first success it had was at controlling the excess air. The stoves generally have far too much air going into them. You should measure the oxygen, and if it's above 9%, you've got too much. So you can see the top of the stove turned red, and it did that because we controlled the air supply. It was balanced to the demand, and the excess air there was around 100-110%. So it gave a very high flame temperature. There's a little quartz window over the hole, and we look and we watch. We can watch the fire developing and doing various things. And there's our physicist and his helper, who was working on this device. It was very, very clean. Now, this was turned into a modular heating stove in late 2010, which was nicknamed by the users the tractor, because it looks like one of those Massey Fergusons with the two wheels at the front. So they called it the tractor because it was, quote, so ugly. So they said, people won't buy a stove that's so ugly. But it worked so well that it became very popular in terms of being accepted by the users. It was extremely efficient. I'm sorry I forgot to put in a thermograph, but we have thermograph photographs of the side of this thing. And it has three units, the burner unit with the hopper. It has a heat exchanger at the back, which if you didn't have a hollow brick wall, you could just use a space heater like a normal stove. And it has a cooking unit which bolts on top. And you could have it in any combination that you like. And you can see by the fire that it's the same sort of layout as before. And here is the last version, or second last version, the 7.4. It was pushed into a single box and made to look neat. It was very clean burning. There was very little welding on it. It was very easy to light. The complications, unfortunately, to make. And it overheated the hopper. This creates, from lignite fuels, far too much gas at some stage. You can't burn it, you can't get enough air in there. And it had therefore suffered from thermal runaway, which was a problem. And it didn't have a very long burning time, maybe 4 hours or so you had to refuel it. So that was a little off message. Anyway, there's the comparison. So by 7 years ago, we already had this. The traditional stove burning the Nalach coal on the left, 5.5 kilograms burned in ignition for 45 minutes typically, and then a refueling episode after only 1 hour and 10 minutes because it already burned all the fuel. And you can see the big spike from the refueling. And it produced 26 grams of PM2.5, which is 4,810 milligrams per kilogram of fuel burned. The 7.4 burned 5.3. Kilograms and produce 0.06 grams for 11 milligrams. That's a reduction of 99.8% PM2.5, which was the main concern. So we've showed already by late 2011 that we can get a 99.5% reduction in PM2.5 without changing the fuel. We did nothing to the fuel except break it to a reasonable size because it comes in pieces like this. Now, in Tajikistan, 2006, there was a request, what can you do with coal burning? They had some really awful coal there called, doesn't matter what it was called, comes from a mine in the south, short name. And it was more like white rocks that burned. And so, desperate to keep the price down, I decided to try, what happens if you only had bricks? You have to use only bricks and a couple of welds. We could accept far worse performance than we were able to achieve in 2010. What would it look like? How would it work? And that's the picture. That's the very first one there of just some angle grinder cut bricks. The bricks are very high quality. They're recovered from old Russian houses where they built sort of built-in ovens and baking things. And they were proper refractory bricks. You can buy them at the market for 70 cents. So there it is. It has almost no heat exchanger. It uses the chimney as the heat exchanger. And this was really clean. And it was 75% efficient or something, and it made virtually no smoke. And I thought, okay, maybe we're onto something. Let's chase this and see what it was. So Kyrgyzstan 2016, I went there to work on their cleaner, their improved stove program. That's the World Bank CSI, Clean Stove Initiative programs. This one incorporates the air bleeder. Now the bleeder in this one is in a different place. It's here. This is a vertical plate. We got the same idea. We're following, we'll go down, and we'll go back up on the other side. And there's a bleeder running across the center to the chimney. And that hole is always open. It's about 40 millimeters square, and it makes sure that the chimney is always at the right temperature. We want to have about 160 degrees where it leaves the ceiling. Then the system will work, and we won't get condensation inside. Again, it used recycled bricks. It had two cooking stations. It could burn for about 8 hours, but that great assembly, which had tubes and pipes and stuff, it turned out to be very difficult to teach people to make it correctly. So, not wanting to give anything up, we pressed on with what can we do with the basic design, but let's just check how did that stove work. Now, this is Altanzul, who's a Mongolian mechanical engineer. She did her master's degree. She finished last year. And this is some of her testing of different fuel sizes, different fuel types, using Shenmue and Shanxi raw coals, which are supposed to be the really bad ones that you hear about in China. And so she was get 7 kilogram burn on a 6.5 hour cycle. The important thing is that at low power, it produced about 10 milligrams of PM2.5 per hour. And if you look at what the EPA is looking for, they're looking at grams per hour. This is 10 milligrams per hour. So it's super, super clean. She had recorded as low as 0.3 milligrams, that's 30 micrograms of PM2.5 per megajoule of heat delivered. This is cleaner than any multi-billion dollar power station. It's phenomenal. Why? Because it's a cross-draft gasifier. That's the core answer. So here's the production prototype from 2017. We're using refractory bricks. The grate has become straightened. It's not indicated in the drawing as straight, but in fact, we managed to straighten the grate. And you see the word gap there? That gap is critical to the functioning of the stove. What it does, it prevents coal from going, I don't want that, coal from going from the hopper here onto the lower grate. By adjusting this gap, you can control the depth of the coke on the bottom of the grate. All the secondary air passes through that coke, which preheats it and cleans it. And so by adjusting the amount of coke, I can make it burn more coke and have less air, or I can have less coke and more air, and I can adjust permanently the excess air ratio and keep it in the range of 70% to 90%, which is oxygen 8% to 9% in the stack. And that's when we get the super, super clean burns. I saw the low pressure boiler version of this in November. 2 hours after ignition, the CO and the PM dropped to zero for an hour and just sat there, 100% perfect combustion. So we're on the right track. We have very positive user response from the users of this, because in the winter of 2016-17, we in Kyrgyzstan, we managed to get a bunch of them into houses. So simplifying the body, this is a very good example. Here you can see clearly that the gap, this is an open and closed flap, so you can bypass it. In Tajikistan, it's too hot. Kyrgyzstan is too hot in summer to stand next to a space heating stove and cook. And it's the only cooking device. So you can open that and bypass it and not have the heating. In Mongolia, that's not required, but in the other two countries, it is. So this one doesn't have, you don't see that bar, in there, that plate in the center, which was making the gases go down and up the other side. This is a downdrafting heat exchanger, and it's more efficient than all those other ones, which have channels that go up and down and back and forth. Here, the heat is dumped at the top of the chamber. It has a bypass to keep the chimney hot at all times, and the gases are slowly pulled down in the heat exchanger, venting from the bottom of that rectangle. This way, the coldest gases are taken to the chimney. There's no plate, which saves money, and it's surprisingly efficient. This was made in South Africa last year, following the DUE conference and the interest, and so we have here one cooking station. You can see the heart pot sitting on that. That proves it's in South Africa. And it has a braai station. Harold prepared us some steaks and stuff on the empty part of the stove. And There's a picture there from inside the grate. Now, the grate goes under the hopper. You saw earlier that the grate is quite long, and it goes under the burning area, the combustion area, and so on. And it sits on the hopper, and you can look inside and see if it's bright red all the way to the door, then you have your pyrolyzation, coke, semi-coking, coking, and gas burning zones. The big advance we have on the ceramic side, Mongolia doesn't make refractory ceramic bricks. You have to buy them from Russia or from China. They're not cheap, they're heavy, and by the time you get to Mongolia, they're valuable. So we did something a bit different here, and this was highly successful, and I'm going to beg the South Africans to at least try this at Northwest. On the top right, you can see piles of plates and parts. Those are all made from plastic refractory materials. We got it from Zhengzhou, but you can get it from other places. Zhengzhou is the home of the Shaolin Temple and the home of Kung Fu. You get out of the station there and it says, welcome to Zhengzhou, the home of Kung Fu. It's like, wow, really there? Well, they have some Kung Fu unbreakable refractory materials there. This stuff is really unusual. It looks like cement. It looks like cement with a small sand premix, and you put aluminum dihydrogen phosphate, which looks like water, pours like water, 13%, and mix it. We're using a cake mixer with a dough hook, about 10 or 12 kilos at a time. And we mix it for 4 minutes. You have 15 minutes to do something with it. You can pack it in by hand. You can put it in molds and so on. So we use little angle iron molds and pack it in on a table and roll it and bang it and so on. And then you leave it alone. You can leave it for a week. You can put it the next day in an oven and dry it at 200 degrees. But when it's dry, it'll take 1,300 degrees. No firing, no clay mixing, no controls, no vacuum pump, nothing. You just mix this stuff up and put it into a box and leave it alone, and you get a 1,300 degree refractory material. It's amazing. It's perfect for small producers because everybody can make their own. You just need a bag of the stuff and the aluminum dihydrogen phosphate. You can explain phosphate bonding of materials at some other time. They're very, very strong. So no kiln, that's the big deal. No kiln, no controls, no power failures, no power spikes. All you need is a spoon and a pot, really, if you wanted to do it. So next, of course, we want cast iron. And so Jalalabad, we found a guy willing to make this for us. On the quick, there's the hopper, and it has a square cover with a round guide. Not a square guide, it's a round guide. And we machine the underside so that it seals on top, and we angle grind the top of it with the whole disc in it, make it flat. It's airtight. And there you see on the bottom left what happens if you rotate it. While the stove is running, if you turn the square cover, it exposes holes, and air can go in there and is drawn in. So you close the air entrance and rotate that. Air goes into it, clears the whole hopper and pyrolyzation zone of all smoke and gases until it's clean, you can see inside, goes up the chimney and burns. Then you can take off the top, no smoke in the house, nothing. Throw in your coal anytime you like, you can refuel it at any time, and then close it again, and then open the air control door. So in this way, we have zero emissions in the house from a refueling episode, even though there's a huge amount of smoke actually inside that zone. Further refinements were being better at cutting the bricks. Kyrgyzstan has one refractory brick maker. They're mostly made of old bricks ground up. He has a hammer mill into which he pours wheelbarrows of bricks. It's very large. And it comes out powder. He fires it with some little bit of white clay, and we get these shapes and forms at the bottom, and we are making brick chambers in Kyrgyzstan, not the plastic refractory, because they can't get the material yet. We're still working on that. We haven't learned yet how to make it. It's a high alumina product. So field evaluations. Now in 2016-17 and again this year, Fresh Air from the Netherlands has been monitoring air quality in the houses, and we've been monitoring people's acceptance. To get a free stove, they have to write down the temperature in the house every 2 hours and outdoors if they're awake. They have to weigh all fuel going into it. They have to record when they fueled it and with what and any other incidental. And they do this for the whole winter. And very happily, because this low pressure boiler, which is exactly the same, you see the hopper cover, there's a little cover there for looking at the fire, and then it has a water jacket around it. I didn't write it in here because I don't want to publish it, but the measured efficiency of this using a Testo 332E was 98.4% thermal efficiency. And the reason was that the chimney next to it was 53 degrees as the exit temperature. And I thought, okay, we're going to have to do something about that, because you can't have a 98% efficient stove and not have a lot of water to deal with, because coal produces a lot of water. So in the brick chimneys, they were very happy with that. There was no condensation issue in the house that they could see, but we're very worried about an efficiency above 90%. So there we go. All right, the bridge. I showed you about the gap. There's a piece over there called the bridge, and it holds the divider between the hopper and the combustion chamber. So this is a cast iron bridge. It's made in the only place that runs in winter in Mongolia. We found a guy. And you can see that there's a different gap there. So they're machined. They're all the same to make it. Then we machine the underside to raise the bridge 5 millimeters, 5 millimeters, 5 millimeters, 5 millimeters. We can also face the front. And the reason is to find that magic spot where the excess air level is just controlled perfectly in the 8 to 9% range, with everything else being relatively fixed. So it's strong, it gets hot, and we can adjust it. So at the present, they're doing a testing matrix of coal size, coal type, and grate height to find out where the magic numbers are for each proposed type of coal. That's going on in Ulaanbaatar. So this is the final product. We're going to market with this. It was finished last week. It is MN is Mongolian 4.2. It is a cross-draft coal gasifier. Top right, you can see the plastic refractory ceramics. It has cast iron on the critical parts. It will include, of course, the top. Highly controllable power. It burns for 14 hours at low power, we are told. In China, we found most stoves are operated on low power always, much to my, I have no idea, I didn't expect that. It was very surprising that we found that almost all the stoves are operated at low power unless they happen to be cooking with it, and many people don't cook with it. So it's quite important. You fill that thing up with coal, and they say 14 hours they have to go and do something. One-touch cooking control, because if you just open it, it comes up. This has a convectively cooled hopper. Now, earlier I said about the GTZ 7.4, it overheated the fuel, produced too much gases from lignites, uncontrollable, and then thermal runaway, 35 kilowatts, way too much power, couldn't cope. So this one is using the room as the heat sink for the hopper. It has 80% space heating efficiency, and it's produced by local artisans, typically who have an angle grinder, a welding machine, and often not even a drill. They only own two tools, and they can make this stove. So we're having a death of a paradigm here. Incidental emissions are decoupled from the mass of coal burned. You can no longer say coal is a dirty, smoky fuel. There's no such thing as a dirty, smoky fuel. Only a fuel stove combination can be given the description dirty. What are you doing? How are you doing it? How are you feeling it? Then you have a result. There's a context. The context has a performance rating. Coal doesn't have a performance rating. So we're overthrowing some generalizations. PM2.5 emissions from small-scale coal combustion was said to be directly related to the tons burned. And these are the people who say that, EPA, EU, WHO, the Global Burden of Disease people, the HAPIT people, which is the DFID, and the International Cryosphere Climate Initiative and so on. All are saying, burn coal, get smoke, get black carbon. It's not true. If you burn coal, you get CO2 and water vapor. If you don't burn the coal, you will get all those other things. Smoke, CO, PAH, VOCs were said to be inherent in the fuel. Finished. It's not true. Black carbon pollution assumed to be the inevitable consequence of coal combustion. Not true. And I don't care if power stations do it. We don't. Coal cannot, by its nature, be burned cleanly or completely. Commonly thought, yeah, no, it's terrible, really awful. Combustion efficiency is really low of the stove. Thank you. Carbon combustion efficiency. This is what it looks like. 99.97% carbon combustion efficiency. The test from last Tuesday, I think. The channels are the diluter, because we have a diluter for the PM measurement, and then the CO2 is the big number there, 9, and 23 ppm CO. And it just sits there. And we go and fiddle with it and throw it and shake the grate and do something, and it messes it up, and it has clouds of ash flying up or whatever, and then it just all calms down again and goes right back to this. It just sits there for the 14 hours. New combustor designs practically eliminate smoke for a practical reason. If you check the uncertainty of the lab equipment, you can say it's undetectable. Lab and performance field tests show this performance. Independent monitoring of indoor air quality by Fresh Air, as I mentioned, Netherlands, has shown large improvements in health. And I think we have a slide here. Here we are. This is from Kyrgyzstan last year. Nairin District, average PM 2.5 in three households, 840, and after we changed the stove, nothing, we changed the fuel, nothing. We have, it's about 25 micrograms per cubic meter, which is people shuffling their feet in the room. And these are the health impacts: headache 65% before, zero. Irritated eyes 70%, zero. Ear infections, none. Irritated throat 72% to 3%. Fatigue, 66% drop to zero. That's carbon monoxide poisoning when they say fatigue. And irritability also, 58%, new stove, zero. And there's pages of this. There's not, we have dozens of things that they check with people just by changing the stove. So, stranded technologies, in case you're promoting these, there's no need, sorry. Electrostatic precipitators, catalytic converters, lambda controllers, 4 semi-coke briquettes. Ah, yes. Philip and his 70-coke briquettes. You hate them too. Higher emissions from semi-coke briquettes on Alton Zuhl's thesis. Cleanest of all fuels was Shenmue raw coal, 16 to 25 millimeters, untouched. Just get it to size. Had the lowest emissions at 0.3 milligrams a megajoule delivered on an 80% efficient stove. We need this. Phosphate bonded high aluma cold setting is fabulous. Cast iron parts and fuel to be sized. And then the equitoxicity issue of PM 2.5, I'm holding this out for Taffy and the others. Please research this, you guys up there. Equitoxicity was never true, and now we have an issue. Is ash as toxic as polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons? I don't think so. So we want to see that this is needs to be looked at. And online videos, if you get this up, you can click and you can see the online videos produced by the BBC, the World Bank, and television stations interviewing people who actually use these stoves. And the relevance for South Africa, my final slide, is you guys have a lot of people using raw coal, burning it very badly in a Mbaula or some other type of stove, a wood stove, for example. And we're going to develop at Northwest University in the coming 3 weeks, a smaller version of the MN4.2 for use in the high felt. And we've already shown that we can reduce the smoke a lot. And those are the acknowledgments from all the people who have helped bring this remarkable thing as well. There's been a great deal of cooperation, as we've reported in previous conferences, between South Africa and China through their science ministries and the cooperation of the Ulaanbaatar Clean Air Project, those three in particular that have brought this to market. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Crispin. They said that you were getting some 43 slides, and you got through absolutely on time. And I think you enlightened the crowds here to the fact that coal is not necessarily a dirty fuel at all. It's you get the right stove combination with your coal, and lo and behold,
kerosene.
Miracles.
What about kerosene?
Oh, don't talk about kerosene.
That's dirty, another dirty fuel.
Another dirty fuel.
Airplanes don't run on kerosene, you know?
I think they do.
No, it's Jet A.
It's kerosene.
It has a different name.
Right, well, I think there's not time really now for any questions, but I think we must thank Crispin very much indeed for this rather amusing, enlightening expose of what's happening in the Far East that we could certainly learn from and do something about the air of the high foot.
I'll be here the whole conference. You can ask me questions later.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And now we have Gerald Swart, who is going to talk to us.